This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us as we discuss the important events of the week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We're going to talk about Russia a lot today. Vladimir Putin's Russia is making a lot of headlines. Last week, it appears Russia tried to assassinate a former spy in broad daylight in Britain. We'll talk about Britain's weak response this week. Yesterday, the Trump administration blamed the Russian government for a series of cyber attacks targeting America's electric grid, factories, water supply. It also imposed some sanctions against certain Russians for election meddling. We'll talk about that and even a bit about what appears to be a direct Russian attack on American troops in Syria. Also, a uranium mining deal the Russians have forged with the Chinese. So there's a lot to be concerned about with Putin's aggressiveness and just how little pushback he's receiving from the West. We followed this story closely as the Trumpet's editor-in-chief is focused on Vladimir Putin, how he has fulfilled and is fulfilling a specific Bible prophecy about a prince of Russia. And Mr. Fleury's also shown that maybe the most important aspect of this story is the way that Europe responds to these tidings out of the East, fulfilling a prophecy in Daniel 11. So we're going to start with a story about that, the urgency within Europe, particularly Germany, in response to what Russia is doing. For this, we will go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, Germany's taking over of various different European military initiatives took another major step forward over the last couple of weeks. On this program, you know, we've talked about this a few times over the last few months. We talked about a NATO rapid reaction headquarters that was going to be set up in Germany under German command, sitting slightly outside of the NATO command structure, so Germany can use that to lead European Union military missions. Well, now they're setting up a marine headquarters. It's going to be in Rostock on the north coast of Germany there, and it's going to be the command center for marine missions, and especially within the Baltic. NATO doesn't have any other command centers for maritime issues in the Baltic. So basically, this puts Germany kind of as the default commander for NATO Baltic missions. The other really interesting thing about this is that Poland is going to set up a new joint command center also in Rostock with Germany. So this is almost kind of separate in a sense from this NATO command structure. The two are going to operate this joint naval center. So this marks a significant step for Poland integrating their military with Germany. They've got several important contracts with Germany to buy, I think, ThyssenKrupp submarines. They've been looking to Germany on land as well, and there are some troop sharing initiatives that they've got. But this is a big step for the two of them to work much more closely together with their navies.
Richard, tell us about the evidence that this is deliberately a response to what's happening in Russia and China.
Well, last year, Russia and China conducted joint naval maneuvers in the Baltic, which is a significant step for these two powers. I mean, the Baltic is a long way from China, quite obviously. So you having China demonstrating their ability to project power around the world, working closely with Russia, just even the heightened tension with Russia automatically puts more focus on the Baltic there. I think Germany, they've been working on this project and this headquarters since 2012, but it does seem very likely that what Russia has been doing and just the general climate of fear about Russia has stepped up the urgency in this project.
So, as you mentioned, this is in addition to the decision last month that the NATO defense ministers made to build a new NATO headquarters in Germany. So you have this initiative on the ground and now this initiative in the water, and both of them put Germany at the front. And both of them seem to be somewhat working independently of the established NATO structure. Is that right?
That's right. And I think it's very interesting that you still have them moving forward with military cooperation with Poland. I mean, if you look purely at things politically and just at headlines, there's a lot of bad blood between Poland and Germany right now, just in the surface. But then you see things like this still moving forwards. It's obviously something that's very important for Poland. Now, they're much closer to Russia than Germany is, and I think they want to do everything that they can to make sure that America will defend them, but then also that Germany will defend them. And they're kind of hedging their bets away from America in one respect. I think if they were 100% certain that America would always come to their aid, I don't think they would be setting up joint naval command centers with Germany. Like I said, that politically there's some differences there. Obviously, historically, the Poles have lots of reasons why they don't want to trust the Germans, but they feel that they can't completely rely on the United States. And then, yes, you have this command, this headquarters that, again, can be used outside of the NATO structure if they want to do that. So you can see Germany kind of also hedging its bets. And you're thinking, well, as we build these headquarters, we've got to make sure that we're flexible. We've got to make sure we're not completely locked into NATO, that we have options to act on our own if necessary.
It's just remarkable that every single time you hear these stories about European military integration, and this is the first time that naval integration has come into the headlines that I can recall, Germany is always right at the center of it.
Right. That's what we wrote just a month or two ago for the Trumpet magazine, that in a lot of ways, Europe is pretty close to having a European army. It's called the Bundeswehr. And yes, they've made much more progress on this on land, like you said, but they're just moving forward with this in so many areas. And it is, you know, I think France does a lot of the talking. And so maybe they get more of the headlines because they're the ones that put forward these great and grand visions for European military. And then just meanwhile, Germany's the one with all of the practical projects working away. And you never hear about, say, I don't know, a French-Spanish or a French-Italian initiative to share with their navies or their military. It's always Germany. And they're just causing all of the nations around them to look to them in that special way for military protection.
So you're really looking at the confluence of three trends here. You see Germany in the pole position with military integration of Europe. You see mistrust in America and the NATO alliance, the transatlantic alliance. You see fear of Russia and the tidings out of the East. I mean, this is kind of the nexus of a whole lot of very prophetically significant trends we're looking at.
Yeah, it really does. And if you look, we have our trend section on the top right-hand corner of the website. And, you know, so many of those we do have trend sections for where you can get a good solid background of, you know, why we're watching this, why the Bible isn't talking exactly about this area. We've got one on a strong man of Germany to lead Europe. We've got one about Europe militarizing. We don't yet have a trends one, I think, on fear of Russia causing Europe to unite, but we do have an article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury. He talked about that. This was all the way back in 2004, Russia frightens Europe and fulfills Bible prophecy. And you look at what has happened since 2004. That was before the Georgia attack. That was before the Ukraine attack. So that was something where he was saying, based on Bible prophecy, watch Russia to become much more aggressive, watch Europe to get more fearful of Russia, to take concrete steps. And compared to where we are now, that trend hadn't even gotten started back then. And so already we've seen what the Bible says about that powerfully vindicated. And then also we had Joshua and I had an article in a recent Trumpet edition called Europe's Underground Army about just all of these different initiatives that Germany is leading to pull this army together. And again, that's something where Bible prophecy just really leaps off the pages of headlines. Because, I mean, aside from Bible prophecy, why would Germany be the one that's leading all of this military integration? The Bible said it would. There's not really any other good reasons that I can think of that it wouldn't be France or Italy or Spain that are using these military, leading these military initiatives. Yet time and time again, you see it's Germany the one doing it, exactly the way you would expect based on Bible prophecy.
Well, amazing to see this happening. All right, let's start talking about what Russia has been up to now. We'll begin with this joint uranium mining project with China. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
This news broke on Monday when one of Russian President Vladimir Putin's advisors told reporters about it's a really massive project that Russia and China have negotiated to build a uranium mine together. So this mine will be in Russia's Zabaykalsky territory, which is there in Siberia, and the project will cost, just to launch, about $330 million. And so the basic goal is to use China's money to harvest 850,000 tons of Russian uranium ore from this mine every year, at least by the time it's up to full capacity. And the advisor said that the project is a breakthrough for creating mechanisms for joint investments in general between Russia and China. And it is a milestone agreement because it's the first time that Russia has ever allowed any kind of foreign investment or operations to touch on its uranium mining industry. And it's also significant because neither Russia nor China have a similarly extensive nuclear energy cooperation arrangement with any other country. So some are saying that this marks a new chapter that's opening up in the history of Russia-China cooperation. And I think that is an accurate read on this agreement.
We were just talking about Russia and China's joint naval maneuvers in the Baltic. This initiative that you're talking about really shows the breadth of the kind of cooperation that we're beginning to see between these two Asian giants. Maybe you could just put it in the larger context of their relationship, why that's so significant.
Sure. Yes. Especially since around 2000 or so, Russia and China have really been leaning on each other. And then we saw that accelerate markedly in 2014 after the West kind of started to shun Russia over the annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. So Russia said, well, if the West doesn't want to be cordial with us anymore, then we'll just bolster all of our cooperation with China. So in the 4 years or so since then, we've seen these two really come very close to forging an official alliance. It's almost at this point an alliance in everything but name. Mm-hmm. Just a very, very close partnership. We see them cooperating in very sensitive sectors, including uranium mining now, which has always been something that Russia's been incredibly protective of and private about. But now they're, since China's their close partner, they're letting them in.
Well, what would be the military implications of an agreement over uranium mining between these two?
Well, they say that this is just for peaceful purposes.
Of course.
Just for to power nuclear power plants. And China does have 38 nuclear power plants. That makes it the fourth highest in the world. And then they've got 20 more reactors under construction. So nuclear power is a massive industry in China. Russia has 36 nuclear reactors in operation right now. 18% of all Russian energy comes from those, or electricity comes from those. So for both countries, just for power, this uranium is in high demand. But we also know that both Russia and China have nuclear weapons. You know, Russia has more nuclear warheads than any other nation on Earth, about 8,000, and 1,600 of those are deployed. And then China has a comparatively modest 250 nuclear warheads, but China has said in recent years that it wants to focus on boosting its nuclear arsenals. So it's not at all difficult to see how this uranium mining project could have kind of clandestine military purposes that Moscow and Beijing are just not talking about right now.
Well, we're going to look at more of Russia's activity in particular. This is the only story that we're looking at that discusses this alignment between Russia and China. For listeners who are unaware of just how much we've focused on this alliance, could you just explain why that is a significant partnership particular?
Yes. Yeah. In terms of Bible prophecy, it's incredibly significant because the Bible does discuss in Revelation 16:12, it talks about the kings of the East as being one of the main players in end time Bible prophecy and in a soon coming nuclear World War III. And it's significant that kings there is pluralized because in other major players in this block, the king of the South, the king of the North, they are often in alliances, but you can tell that there's a single figure that's heading it in a way. But with the kings of the East, it's pluralized, and that shows that this really will be a confederation of nations. And then if you look at prophecies such as Ezekiel 38, it talks about which specific nations will be in that block. And it shows that the prince of Rosh will be at the head of it. And it mentions the land of Magog. And those are just ancient names for Russia and China. So really, if you look at these Bible prophecies, then it's incredibly significant that we see modern Russia and modern China now forming a close partnership.
We have a trend article on thetrumpet.com called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. We also have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. Do check those out. If you have not studied into why this is such a significant trend that we're watching closely, then be sure to prove that to yourself. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We'll look now at a couple of stories of Russian aggression toward Britain and America, starting with the fallout from that attempted assassination in Britain, almost certainly the work of the Russians. We have an article on thetrumpet.com right now called The Kremlin's Fingerprints on Nerve Agent Attack in UK. Jeremiah wrote that along with Jack Wood. Brad McDonald wrote about this British response in his Trumpet brief yesterday, which, if I might slip in a word, I would encourage you to subscribe to this free daily email service. It's a very helpful digest of what's happening on the Trumpet. But Mr. McDonald wrote, Vladimir Putin more psychopath than cowboy, and he explained why Britain's response is so concerning. For this, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Well, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the details. We talked about this last week, Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, they were attacked. And as has been pointed out since then, this was the first offensive use of a nerve agent on the territory of a NATO member ever. I think it was a German politician, I think maybe the defense minister, that pointed out that this is one of the first chemical attacks to have taken place in Europe since World War II. So it is a very serious response. I mean, in the UK, there have been, I think, 500 people been told that we're in the area. Well, you should go and clean in your set, like, you know, be careful. You might have some of this nerve agent on you or on your belongings. So it's something that poses a serious risk to the public. It's something that has really outraged the nation. But the response has been underwhelming. So the actual response so far that Britain has led is that they've kicked out 26 diplomats. Britain's defense minister said, and I quote, frankly, Russia should go away and shut up. That's his. I'm sure Vladimir Putin is shaking in his boots. I think what's most worrying, though, is you look how the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn responded, and Theresa May gave a big speech in Parliament. For her, actually, I think it was quite aggressive. She said there's no alternative solution other than the Russian state was culpable. But then Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, got up and basically said, well, we can't be sure that Russia was behind it. Vladimir Putin said he wants to do some tests on some of the nerve agent. We should give it to him so he can run those tests. Yeah, just a very weak, that we should maintain a robust dialogue with Russia. He then followed that up with an article in The Guardian basically saying, well, no, we need to make sure that this doesn't lead to a new Cold War. We've got to make sure that we don't jeopardize our relations with Russia. Now, to their credit, his party, the Labour Party, was just about unanimous in condemning him for that. But you've got the Conservatives now offering a very weak response. And then you've got the other party, at least the leader and the leadership of that party, offering an even weaker response and even divided in whether the nation should have a response at all. And so you can see why Vladimir Putin isn't going to be deterred from this kind of act, those kinds of acts, as Mr. McDonald brought out in that Trumpet brief. I mean, even the response from Britain's Conservatives shows just a fundamental lack of understanding at the evil that they're dealing with here. Jeremy Corbyn's response shows a fundamental lack that they're dealing with any evil at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a weak response. Now, to be fair, Theresa May couldn't have got up and said, we're going to assassinate in retaliation this agent, this agent, this agent, and that agent. threats, and she did promise kind of additional, more secretive measures. So maybe there is something in the pipeline. There is still that possibility. But you look at Britain's track record to standing up for this kind of thing, and this is Alexander Litvinenko's poisoning was the other high-profile occasion when he was poisoned with polonium-210 on the streets of London. But there have been many other Russian assassinations, and Britain's response has been mild. So this is after a long track record, a long pattern here, and it's just a refusal to stand up to evil and just really comprehend the type of person that, that the nation's dealing with.
Yeah, I think the point that Mr. McDonald made in that trumpet brief that stood out to me was just how brazen Vladimir Putin was in greenlighting this attack. This is, you know, in the streets of London in broad daylight. And it show the response of the British shows just how he's running exactly the right calculus in making these kinds of decisions. He really has nothing to fear in retaliation for doing this type of thing.
Yeah, it does remind me, it was right after, back in 2014, right after the Russian invasion of Crimea, that the former German defense minister, Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, had done an editorial on how Putin's operating in a leadership vacuum and saying that he appears so powerful, and he actually is so powerful just because there's really no world leader not right now that's standing up to him. Which is some pretty amazing insight, because you even compare like Russia to the U.S. and their economy is roughly equivalent to that of New York City. Their defense budget's a tenth of what ours is. They've got one aircraft carrier that needs a tugboat to pull it around. So just as far as like logistics, this is not nearly as strong a nation as it looks, and what based on what it's accomplished, and a lot of what it's accomplished is just due to the fact that it just has a very strong, decisive leader. And for some reason or another, in Britain and in America and even in Germany right now, there's just really no one who wants to counter that ambition.
I think just another way of looking at this as well, just another example of how the West completely has underestimated what Putin is capable of, even going back to Syria and the deal with Bashar al-Assad, who had chemical weapons, and the West says, at which point the United States looked like they might have acted to take away those chemical weapons from Assad. And Putin comes in and says, don't worry, everyone, we'll take the stockpile of chemical weapons of Assad. We're a trustworthy player on the world scene. The United States claps their hands and says, wonderful. I think the UK did the same thing. And here we have Putin numerous times. Has used chemical agents. Now, I'm not saying these came from Syria necessarily, but it does show how the West has definitely underestimated the type of man that Putin is.
Well, let's go ahead and just transition over into the evidence of Russia coming after America. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah.
Yes, well, there was one small story that it's been fairly quiet just because there's kind of a dearth of concrete evidence about it. The governments of both Russia and the U.S. have been fairly silent about this. They've downplayed it. But in early February, Russian mercenary forces, apparently on orders approved by Moscow, launched an assault on a known American base there in Syria. And, you know, as I said, we don't know a lot of details about this, but it seemed to be kind of a testing of the waters from Vladimir Putin's Russia. Just wanted to see how the U.S. would respond. He knows that America is weak and that our will to use our power is broken. So he just kind of poked and prodded a little bit there. The U.S. did respond with force, as you would expect after such a brazen attack. It looks like the U.S. used helicopters and jets and gunships and apparently killed dozens of these Russian mercenaries. But just to attempt something like that and to take that kind of a gamble is just really, it's really brazen and pretty shocking. But it does show that Russia has no fear of the United States. And then on Thursday of this week, news broke of another story showing the exact same lesson. And this is U.S. officials revealed that Russia has carried out a whole series of cyber attacks that targeted America's electrical systems, water systems, nuclear power plants, factories, and even air travel systems. So the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, they released screenshots showing that these Russian hackers got so deep into these critical American systems that they were in a position to sabotage or shut them off if they had wanted to. So they never did shut one down, but they had their finger just resting on the switch. Mm. And the Russians apparently wanted the U.S. and the world to see that they had hacked all the way into the heart of these critical systems, because they wanted to send a message. The message is that if there is a war between us and you, you better be ready to fight us in the dark. Hmm. You know, you better be ready to fight us with your cities in chaos, with the power turned off, with the water turned off. So it's
chilling.
A pretty brazen attack there as well.
So what's the evidence that points back to Moscow on this?
Well, you know, Moscow in typical fashion denies that they had anything to do with these attacks. They always try to paint Russia as entirely guiltless, even when Moscow's fingerprints are all over the crime scene. They say that if it was Russian hackers, then they were rogues who were not acting on government orders. But the evidence does show that these kinds of operations, like the famous Internet Research Agency and the Fancy Bear operation and others, these are unofficial government entities. Mm-hmm. And they are following Kremlin orders. And in a lot of cases, the Russian government actually does want that to be clear to the world.
You know, well, it's almost like that nerve agent, like we were talking last week about how they... It's almost like a calling card where there's a brazenness about it. Same type of a situation here, apparently.
Exactly. Yes, they officially deny it, but they also want the message to be clear. Mm-hmm. You know, that Russia is powerful. They can kill traitors in the UK and the US. They can take out vital US infrastructure. So that threat is lost if there's no evidence at all linking those sorts of things to the Russian government. But it's really just typical Russia. They lie, but they know that the world knows they're lying, and they actually hope the world knows they're lying. Otherwise, half of their threat is lost.
So that's amazing. So in this particular case, Donald Trump actually came out and said, well, hey, wait a minute. We know all about this and kind of blew the whistle on it. What do you make of the U.S. response to this?
Yeah, there has been some response. 19 Russian individuals were sanctioned. These sanctions freeze any assets that the individuals may have in U.S. jurisdictions, and they ban Americans from doing business with these 19 people.
And these are the same people that were indicted in the Mueller investigation.
That's right, yes. There's a lot of overlap here. I think 13 of the 19 are indicted. Yep. in both situations. But these 19 people have no assets in the United States that would be covered by these sanctions. So really it's largely symbolic and toothless. And it just doesn't seem like it's anything that Trump is willing to take a stronger response to.
So really it's similar to what we're seeing with the British response. To this point, Theresa May has basically said, well, we're going to withhold some of the spectators from Britain in the Russian World Cup. Here, Donald Trump is saying, well, we're going to cut off economic activity with these 19 people who have no economic activity with the United States. Not exactly something that's going to cause Vladimir Putin to tremble.
Yeah, not at all. These are slaps on the wrist. It's not to say that a stronger response may not be forthcoming from Theresa May or from Donald Trump. But at this point, I don't think that what we've seen would be anything that would give Putin pause.
So the idea of Russia essentially telling the United States, we can shut you down at will, that's quite extraordinary. And it does fulfill a prophecy that we've drawn attention to quite a few times, or it certainly could lead to the fulfillment of that prophecy.
Yes. Yeah, this paints a very gloomy picture where the U.S. could be basically shut down, thrown into chaos at the push of a button. It shows that we're far more fragile than we would like to admit. And this is a situation for the U.S. that, in a general way, the Bible warns about. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been warning for years about America's excessive reliance on technology and specifically cyber technology, saying that this puts us at great risk of attack. And he has placed this in the context of a really sobering scripture from the book of Ezekiel. Back in 1995, he wrote an article called America's Achilles Heel. And one quote from that says, Let's look at an alarming scripture. Ezekiel 7:14 says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none go to the battle, for my wrath is upon all the multitude thereof." And then Mr. Fleury says, "The trumpet of war was blown in Israel, mainly America and Britain. It seems everybody was expecting our people to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurred. Nobody went to battle, even though the trumpet was blown. Will it be because of computer terrorists?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly something that, just thinking about what Vladimir Putin is threatening here, you can't help but think about just how devastating that would be were they to follow through with the threat that they've made here. And at the same time, it's just remarkable looking at both of these situations to see the weakness of the United States and Britain in responding to this. You've both said that, you know, well, there could be a stronger response to come, but the evidence of the broken will of the United States and Britain is just absolutely overpowering. And that's something that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about, decades ago in writing The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that prophecy in Leviticus 26 and verse 19 about just the will being broken as being a curse on these nations for their disobedience to God. We're seeing it right before our eyes. Well, I appreciate that, gentlemen. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about more of Russia's activities, this in Syria, as well as the development of a possible North Korean military base in that country. We'll also look, in light of the student protests over gun laws in America, at the unprecedented generation gap in American politics. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Russia has had a fairly strong relationship with Iran as long as their interests have aligned. But how strong is that partnership? For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
This partnership has been extremely fruitful for both parties inside Syria as they've come together to support Bashar al-Assad in his quest to stay in power. And it seems now, at least according to Iranian media outlets, that as the Syrian war dies down, even though it was a bloody day, very bloody day today, the Iranians are worried that they are going to miss out on some of the post-war benefits. They are worried that they're being sidelined by the Syrian regime in favor of Russia. And the article that has really put together a number of quotes from Iranian newspapers came out on March 12th in El Monitor. It's entitled "Iranian Mistrust of Russia Surges as Syrian War Winds Down." And I'll just quote one paragraph here. It says, "Now Iranians are suspicious of Russia's role in Syria and what are seen as Russian attempts to bypass Iran, which has paid a steep price to keep Bashar al-Assad in power in Damascus. Media outlets' reports seem to play into these fears and doubts of much of the public." And so it definitely looks like this is happening in some instances. The Iranians newspapers are saying that if Iran does want to take part in the reconstruction, that they're not going to have to talk to Assad. They're actually going to have to talk to Russia first. These are comments published, again, in Iranian media.
So what is the evidence that Iran is looking at that's causing them concern here?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, I'll just quote from a January 17 report. Inside a news agency in Iran that's got close ties to the IRGC, they said that there has been an agreement that has been worked out between Russia and Syria, and that in this agreement, Iranian companies have been partly put aside in the process of reconstruction and investment inside Syria. This is worrying for Iran. Just that one quote is, as far as the Iran likes to insert itself into foreign governments through the use of through large contracts, reconstruction contracts, building of different refineries or different things in the commercial sector, in which the Iranian agents that actually work there in those foreign territories have links to the IRGC, which goes all the way back to Khomeini. And so they're worried there's been an agreement between Syria and Russia that they've been left out of that. There's also the attempt of Iran to build a naval base right next to the Russian naval base in Tartus. That was actually slammed. The door was slammed shut on that naval base by Russia with the support of the Syrian regime. And so the Russians aren't allowing the Iranians to have a naval base in the Mediterranean. This is coming really at odds with the Iranian goal here of supporting Assad, and that was to further entrench itself in Syria. It looks like, up to this point, the Syrians are siding more with the Russians in allowing them to have free reign in post-Syria rather than the Iranians.
So the relationship between Iran and Syria, you know, a lot of observers have said this is they are thick as thieves. This isn't going anywhere. The United States or the trumpet, we've actually said, no, there is going to be a division, that the alliance between Iran and Syria is prophesied to sever. Are we seeing the beginnings, even with Assad still in power, of the division between these two?
I think this is the very surprising point that a lot of people that have watched this are taking it back, just a step back and reanalyzing the situation, because Assad has been for so long married or wed to Iran, and the Russians were wed to the Syrian institutions more. And so that is the question. Are we seeing Assad realizing how strong the Russian force is right now, not necessarily inside Syria, but on the world scene? Is Assad starting to side more with the Russians at the expense of the Iranians? We are watching for such a thing to take place, for the Iranians to lose control of Syria. It looks like that wedge could be initially driven in between them by Russia. We could be witnessing that prophesied break through Russia's hand right now.
You know, it's funny because we've been watching this thinking for how long has it been now? 4 or 5 years. That it would be the fall of Assad that would precipitate that division, that it would be a change in government, that the regime would change, and maybe someone would come to power who would have more of a pro-European, anti-Iranian bent. And, of course, that still may happen. I mean, this is a pretty murky situation here, but just considering, I guess, how contrary to what appearances have been, that our biblically based forecast has been in this region, it is quite something to see evidence that it might be actually coming to pass.
Yeah, I think something that people can read just to show where we're coming from with this story is just an article written a couple of years ago on the Trumpets entitled "Get Ready for Drastic Change in Syria." And it looks at how the Russians were invited by the Iranians into this arena to help them here prop up Assad. And yet it looks like it could backfire on them.
And I suppose just as far as the prophecy, getting more detail about the prophecy that we're looking at, that mysterious alliance portion of the King of the South booklet kind of gives the biblical background to that. Certainly something to check out if you want more information about that. While we have you, Brent, reports this week of the U.S. monitoring what looks like North Korean activity there in Syria. Tell us about that.
According to satellite images, and this was from local media from the area that the United States has picked up on, but according to satellite images and a military source in the region, they have seen for several years now the construction of an underground base in Syria, in Bashar al-Assad's hometown, or really close to it. And there is a lot of secrecy attached to it. Even the Syrians say there's a lot of secrecy attached to it, just because it's overseen by North Koreans. Part of the construction of this base is it's kind of a base that fits the model for the North Koreans, just because they do a lot of their or house a lot of their military might and missiles, and also a lot of their nuclear nuclear development facilities. They are underground, and for this to happen in Syria, for the North Koreans to be trying to do this doesn't seem out of the ordinary at all.
So we're at this moment where there's excitement in the White House, or at least some level of optimism that North Korea may be willing to disband its nuclear program. Dismantle its program. But we've had evidence for a long time that North Korea's activities in creating weapons of mass destruction isn't restricted to its own territory. There's been a lot of talk, and Gerald Flory talks about this quite a lot in his Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door booklet, collusion between North Korea and Iran. Here we're seeing it with Syria.
Yeah, it's really interesting just to look at those three nations, Iran, Syria, and North Korea, each of them having nuclear programs at a certain period. If you can go back to Syria, it was in 2007 that a nuclear facility was destroyed by the Israelis, just because that was made public. But then going to Iran, they started to draw down on their nuclear program in 2012, started to look to the United States for a deal. And at that moment, we see Iranian inspectors, Iranian operatives in North Korea, and they're watching at least three or four North Korean weapons tests, nuclear weapons tests in North Korea. And so Iranian program might die down. And then we have the North Korean program that picks back up. And so here we are back in 2018. It looks like the North Korean program might die back down, and yet they're working together in Syria. And so for all the hopes that we're seeing an end to nuclear proliferation through these nuclear deals, it's like the three nations are colluding together and just jumping around the world, continuing their tests, continuing their development, unabated, just in a different location. And this is something, as you said, that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, draws attention to a lot. He wrote back in the 2016 Trumpet print edition an article entitled "The Worst Foreign Policy Blunder in American History." And he has a whole section in there on the Korean connection to the Iranian nuclear deal. And he even mentions what's happening in Syria as well. And so for the backstory of this, I definitely encourage our listeners to go back and read that.
Well, thank you for that, Brent. All right, we're going to finish with a story in America. We've been witnessing protests all over the country from high school students who are demanding more gun control, and they're saying, the adults have failed us. We are taking over. A new Pew poll shows that the gap between the political views of young people and older people in America has never been greater. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, it's pretty well known that younger people generally do vote more liberal than older people. This has been something that's been observed throughout human history. But as you mentioned, this new Pew poll shows that just the dramatic divergence in America is becoming really stark, and actually even to the point of being alarming, where that they were looking at approval ratings for past presidents during their first year in office. And according to this Pew poll, they found amongst the baby boomer generation, President Trump has a 44% approval rating right now. But amongst the millennial generation, it's down to 27%. So that's a 19-point difference between the baby boomers and the millennials on how they think President Trump is doing his job. They actually went back and showed that there was a little narrower, but a similar divergence during the Obama administration. But then when you go back before the millennial generation hit voting age, like back during the presidencies of George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, there really wasn't much difference between the oldest demographic and the youngest demographic, maybe 4 to 6 points difference, with the younger demographic voting a little more liberal, a little more pro-Democratic Party. But it's really only been since the millennial generation, the generation born between 1981 and 1996, has come of voting age, that you just start seeing this stark divergence, where the vast majority of them vote for one political party, while their elders vote for the other political party. I think the last election, about age 45, seemed to be the tipping point, where everyone 45, or not everyone, but the majority of people below 45 voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election, and the majority of people above 45 voted for President Trump.
Yeah, we have exactly the same trend mirrored in the UK with the so-called youthquake with Jeremy Corbyn. I remember we talked about him a bit earlier, but you've got this guy dramatically on the left, way to the left of Bernie Sanders, massively rejected by older generations, and yet overwhelmingly embraced by younger generations. Now, it's interesting, though, that the one big segment of older generations that did like him were teachers, educators.
Yeah. Well, it does show just how much To me, it seems like when you talk about embracing a politician like Jeremy Corbyn and a politician like Hillary Clinton, that a lot of that, and Bernie Sanders, he was also the one who seemed to capture the imaginations of so many of the younger people, that there's this collective embrace of very quite radical socialist policies and government intervention that the older people aren't interested in.
Right, especially here in America, Hillary Clinton kind of tried to avoid the socialist label, even if she embraced the policies, partially because she might want trying to win over a couple of the older voters. But both Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders are self-avowed socialist. Mm-hmm. And now that Clinton's lost the last election in America, it really does look like the what they call the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party's kind of resurgent, and will probably be much more powerful in the next presidential election in the U.S. And like I said, that is really just capturing the minds of the youth. I know one of our trumpet writers, Mr. Dennis Leap, had his article, "They Say They Want a Revolution," that really talks about like the parallels between the Bernie Sanders youth movement and the French Revolution, which was just a violent bloodbath back when France was trying to overturn their old regime, and just showing kind of the potential for that in America, where you've got this generation of like below 45, especially the below 30s, that are embracing more of like socialist policies, the desire for a big government that can implement those policies, mm-hmm. And just bringing a lot of emotion to the table. That same Pew report, I mean, it does break down on a number of issues: racism, immigration, same-sex marriage, abortion, global warming, gun policy, marijuana legalization. There's just this divergence between those in the millennial generation and those in the upper three, the Generation X, Baby Boomer, and Silent Generation.
Well, you listen to the arguments that they're making for gun control, and there's essentially a 19-year-old shoots up some kids in a high school, and it is the fault of Washington lawmakers who are in the back pocket of the NRA. So they're blaming the government for not protecting them, and they're basically calling the National Rifle Association, which is, you know, ostensibly it's an organization that's meant to protect the Second Amendment of the Bill of Rights within the United States. They're calling them child killers, as if they're the ones that pulled the trigger on the school. And they're basically saying, we demand that the government protect us. So this willingness to cast the Second Amendment aside and put their trust in the very leaders, or at least the system that they're protesting against, is quite extraordinary. I mean, it strikes me as putting a lot of trust in government in a way that there's a comfort level with the government and with socialist policies, with large government interventions, that you don't see in previous generations, or that certainly wasn't there at America's founding. And that older Americans who have some sense of that history aren't comfortable with.
Right. There's definitely both an idealism and just a naiveness in these policies, is that obviously anyone should be able to see that someone goes into a school, shoots up someone, that he's the bad guy, and you want to stop the bad guys. But that's about as far as the reasoning process got, where you're like, all right, well, stop the bad guy, we need to take his gun away. Who's going to take the gun away? Well, the government will take the gun away. And that'll be the solution to school shootings, where when you do get back to the founding fathers' generation, or some of these older generations, that they realize that when you look at the broad scope of history, generally those nations where the people are disarmed are at the mercy of whatever policies their government wants to impose upon them. It's the nations like the early Roman Republic and the United States, where they're just heavily based on armed, independent citizens and self-sufficient families, where they're not dependent on the government, can even defend themselves against a tyrannical government if necessary, where freedom has flourished more.
Not sure if I would hold up the Roman Republic as as an example of a strong, stable society that has weapons. It kind of descended into a bit of a bloodbath. But completely aside, what I was going to say is, to me, the common thread between a whole lot of what the young people are demanding in the UK, in America, on all of these other issues, is just this belief in kind of like a magic solution and the government just kind of waving its wand and fixing it. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's like, okay, well, we've student loans or high prices of university tuition fees. Wave one, free university, problem solved. Too many house prices, or too many, you know, rent going up, house prices going up, boom, rent controls. Government passes a law, rents are limited. There's gun crime, boom, we'll just pass a law, we'll make guns illegal. We won't necessarily even think about, even if that were a desirable destination, how do you get there? What practical steps do you even take to try and get rid of the huge number of guns that are in America already? No taking into account of, you know, well, maybe the founding fathers actually knew what they were talking about when they set up this constitution and put in place some, you know, none of that. It's just a magic solution. Mm-hmm. And the magic solutions all come from the government.
Yeah, yeah. I saw some polls, some questions they're asking, especially to the young people supporting Bernie Sanders in the last election, where they're like, well, do you want universal health care? They're like, yes. Like, well, who should pay for the universal health care? They're like, the government. Should the government increase taxes? They're like, well, no. like, how do you think the government's going to pay it? They're like, I don't know. I haven't thought about it much.
Right. Or the 1%.
Right. You are the 1%, which actually, if you passed high school mathematics, even if you took everything the 1% owns, like assets, income, all of it, it's still actually not enough to pay for Bernie Sanders' healthcare program. Even not adjusting for the negative impact it would have on the economy of taking all the money from the job creators. If you just write out government theft, took everything away, you've got about maybe half the amount of money you'd need to cover universal health care.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. Stephen Fleury talked about this on his Trumpet Daily radio show yesterday, and just pointing to the prophecy in Isaiah 3 about how women and children will rule, children taking over with the political voice. Really, it's remarkable to see how many politicians are looking and listening to these children and basically saying, this is the voice of reason and wisdom within our country. They're listening to these young people as if, you know, those children who are those teens, those high schoolers who are grieving over what happened in their school, that their pronouncements about what we should do about guns carry greater weight, more wisdom than those of the founders of the country, those who drafted the Bill of Rights. But that is the really a very direct fulfillment of that prophecy in Isaiah 3. We appreciate that, Andrew. Before we go, we spoke last week about how the new South African president's pledge to redistribute land from white farm owners could pose some serious problems in South Africa. You have an update on that situation.
Yeah, actually, this week is a little surprising, but Australia's Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, made some comments where he was just really saying how bad things are getting for farmers in South Africa, and is he actually making a proposal to grant like political asylum to white farmers who want to flee the country. Now, I think he's probably going to get some pushback from that from other members of the Australian government, so we'll see if that actually pans out for them. But it does, this is a really strong highlight of how serious things are getting in South Africa when you've got the Home Affairs Minister of a country like Australia coming out and says that, no, we actually need to grant asylum to white farmers from South Africa because they could be facing high levels of crime approaching to what Genocide Watch has even called a potential genocide in the recent past.
Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and you can find links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed today, quite a few of them on today's program, and a lot of resources that you can look at. If you want more information about what we talked about, you can email us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
No
worries.
Been a pleasure.
It's been a fun show.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of James Allen. Only the wise man, only he whose thoughts are controlled and purified, makes the winds and the storms of the soul obey him. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.